You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Colson. This is Minute 59. This minute opens with Holloway saying, "Okay, I guess you can take your father's cross off now," and ends with him telling Shaw, "You're the most special person I've ever met in my life." Wow, so last episode we took a deep dive into genetics, and now this episode is going to be a pretty heavy episode, philosophically speaking. We've got religion and reproduction on the agenda tonight. Hold on to your butts.
Okay. Guess you can take your father's cross off now.
Why would I want to do that?
I love the way Shaw says, "Why would I want to do that?" She's a bit cheeky about it. Clearly, this is a discussion they've had before.
Because they made us.
And who made them?
I think this moment solidifies Shaw as a character. When I first watched Prometheus, I was thinking, how could she be a Christian and a scientist? How could she seek out these creators, but not see them as gods or something that completely dismantles her faith? But this one line here is a neat way to sum it up. I understood her. She is a scientist, she respects the material and the quantifiable, but God exists somewhere else in her mind. He, or it, is on another plane of reality. When I was in Catholic school, I reasoned that science was not opposed to religion. It was simply a means of understanding how God made the world. Understanding the complex mechanics that underlie everyday phenomena does not defy or dispel God. Not inherently. If one were so inclined, one could take this as merely understanding the underlying principles of God's machinations. Human beings are very good at creating narratives as a means of justifying their beliefs and perception of reality. I have mentioned it before, but it bears mentioning again. I define myself as agnostic. It's the most logical conclusion to come to. I can neither prove nor disprove the existence of a higher power or powers. And in an infinite universe, there's probably some weird shit out in the deepest reaches of space, time, and maybe even the multiverse. Maybe there's a Galactus floating out there somewhere. I am not so arrogant as to claim I am special and know all the answers. I cannot understand the concept of faith. It's the same with emotions. I don't really experience them for myself. So these concepts are fascinating to me, and I respect those who have experiences outside of my own comprehension. It's like everyone else runs on an entirely different operating system to me, which is exciting, and that's why I like people and like learning about their experiences. I admire the beauty of the things that only exist in the human mind. I respect those who get something out of religion, that it comforts and inspires them and creates a sense of community in them. The closest thing I think I could compare it to is, for example, when I watch Cosmos. When Carl Sagan says, "The cosmos is within us. We are made of star stuff. We are the way for the universe to know itself." That, to me, is such a beautiful quote. It's awe-inspiring. It's the kind of thing that helps you make sense of yourself and your life. This ties into what I was saying about having a spiritual center. I got into mindfulness, meditation, and Buddhist philosophy through Sam Harris, and I have found that I identify a lot with Buddhist teachings. Not entirely, I'm not a practicing Buddhist, but I find these ideas, they give me a spiritual and a moral compass. It helps inform who I am and makes me a better person. I know for a fact that when I was a teenager and a militant atheist and a physicalist, I was lacking something in my core. You can't make sense of the world if you don't have a sense of yourself. And we see that in this scene, to the point that Holloway literally asks Shaw to remove a physical symbol of her faith, as if that would change anything. Now don't get me wrong, having beliefs can be a bad thing too. Ever heard of the backfire effect? People tend to double down on their beliefs when confronted with conflicting evidence, or alter the evidence to suit their narrative. This is why detectives and forensic scientists are discouraged from entering a crime scene with any preconceptions or predictions. They must simply observe the evidence as objectively as possible. And sure, I cannot deny that there are those people who twist religion into a weapon. But in Shaw's case, I can admire her devotion, even if the screenwriters don't really know what they're talking about. Science and religion aren't truly opposed, to quote Anna Saleh of ABC Science. Some argue that being religious is incompatible with being a scientist. But do they realize the father of the Big Bang Theory was actually a Catholic priest? The pioneer of modern genetics was an Augustinian monk, or the decoder of the human genome converted from atheism to Christianity in his 20s. Now, I'm not here to discuss a long, complex history of the relationship between science and religion, but there is a great episode of Star Talk, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson, that delves into the topic. For example, turns out Jesuit priests also do science. As is mentioned in that podcast, many people are not aware that in the medieval period, if you wanted to learn anything, you went to a monastery. It was one of the few academic resources available at the time. So, what's my point? Where am I going with this? Well, I don't want to jump to any conclusions just yet. I want to slowly evaluate how faith, or a lack of faith, impacts the journey our protagonists go on here. Why is it that Holloway is so depressed? And what makes Milburn and Fifield so scared, or Shaw so confident and content? How does mindset and philosophy impact people in a situation that is larger than life? Viewed from this perspective, I think Prometheus takes on a whole new meaning. We have a diverse ensemble of characters here, and their journeys are informed by their philosophical perspectives. Wayland and David consider themselves equal or superior to God. Shaw is a true believer, and the rest seem to be atheists. Of course, in real life, it rains on the just and unjust alike. May as well throw in a Bible quote in this episode. Or, in this case, mutagen affects the just and unjust alike. In real life, it doesn't matter if you're a good or bad person. Survival is pure chance. But in a movie, it's deliberate. Certain characters are killed, and there's generally a meaning behind that choice. Take, for example, the slasher movie. The teens sneak off to have sex in the woods, and you know the slasher is going to target them first. Why? To reinforce the idea that they're doing something wrong or taboo, especially in contrast with the virginal heroine. Charlie responds to Shaw asking who made them.
Well, exactly. We'll never know.
He says that with such certainty and conviction. I don't think he's really thinking about what he's saying here. He wanted to talk to God. These engineers turned out to be a disappointment. But he doesn't hold out hope for something higher than these aliens. Again, absolute physicalist. There's no evidence of anything besides the engineers. So he can't even invest in the notion on a hypothetical level. He doesn't even say, maybe. He says, exactly, we'll never know. Definitively. And yet, I am willing to bet, if he found even a hint of evidence that indicated something beyond humanity and the engineers, he'd be all over it. He invested a lot into those stone tablets, and they were pretty shaky evidence, let's be honest here. This scene is brilliant, because in a few short sentences, we're getting an understanding of these characters, their relationship, and their worldviews.
But here's what we do know, is that there is nothing special about the creation of life, right? Anybody can do it. I mean, all you need is a dash of DNA and half a brain, right?
I can't create life. What does that say about me?
Ellie, that's not, I wasn't talking about...
Children?
Us. Hey. Elizabeth Shaw, you are the most special person I've ever met.
I always found this so on the nose, just the delivery. But the intention behind it, I get it. And it's nice to have a female character who is a strong, career-oriented woman who also wants children. I like that about Black Widow as well. And that Ripley and Sarah Connor are the ultimate mama bears. It seems a contentious point amongst feminists. And I get it, women have been treated as nothing but baby factories for centuries. And I know as a man I don't really get to have an opinion here, but I am going to keep talking anyway because I am a man and I am entitled. No, just kidding. But I don't know. Maybe it's because I grew up reading Fantastic Four and watching The Incredibles. I think it's cool to see parents who can also be heroes. And for those characters that can't have a family, that's a really relatable desire or problem I think a lot of people have. I personally would love to foster children one day, but I just can't see that happening because I have a chronic illness. So I can definitely relate to it on some level. Really, my only issue with this scene is that it's played way too straight or maybe too dramatic. Shaw gets so teary-eyed in under a second. I think anger or even just glaring at Charlie or giving him a playful slap for forgetting and being so inconsiderate would have felt like a more genuine human reaction. Her response here would be more appropriate if she was confessing this for the first time or if Charlie talked about wanting children. I mean, I'm autistic and I can tell this isn't how human beings interact. For a franchise all about reproduction, I think it's clever to make it clear that our protagonist is unable to conceive and then invert that in the most horrific way imaginable. And the horror is coming soon. I have to admit though, I've always found the first half of this movie more compelling than the second half. Don't get me wrong, I love it all. I think it was Phil from minutes 47 to 49 who said he would have preferred something slower and more ponderous and to see these mutations and creatures as neither good or evil, but as life. It's indifferent, it's morally neutral. Alien Covenant suffers from the same thing. Every time the xenomorph or xenomorph-adjacent creatures show up, it feels contractually obligated. It's simply not the story Ridley wants to tell. He wants engineers and androids, and that much is evident in these prequels. I could easily watch hours of characters making discoveries and having these philosophical debates. I mean, movies like Arrival and Annihilation and Ex Machina did alright commercially, so there is an audience for it. And I think in an ideal universe, I'd like Fox to realize that, to go, alright, what Ridley's doing isn't the Alien movie or the Alien franchise we wanted, but we'll give him the third one and let him just go all out, go real weird, do all the engineer, android, existential, god stuff. You do that. And then they can make another Alien franchise where it is xenomorphs, your typical bug hunt marine stuff that is the, you know, that's the crowd-pleasing stuff. And I don't think there was any truth to it, but if James Cameron were to have any sort of involvement in this universe again, that does sound like a likely direction to go in. God damn, I am only 30 seconds into this minute. Onwards. So, Charlie knows he fucked up and consoles Shaw. We see a kinder, gentler side to him. A side only Shaw likely sees. Again, the whole conflict feels a bit forced with regards to infertility, but it is much better than the aggressive scene that was originally intended and filmed. Let's compare the deleted scene to the script I read a few episodes back, shall we? I'm going to play a lot of the audio from this scene because it's bizarre, especially to see how hostile this scene could have played out. I'll put it in the footnotes too so you can see how differently it was staged and filmed as well. It's just a nice reminder of how flexible film can be and what can be possible within the same parameters.
You're drunk.
Hi.
Embarrassing, Charlie.
Wow. You know, he seems pretty scared for a ghost.
It's not a ghost.
Yeah, what is it?
It's a recording. Some kind of video log. We must have triggered it when we came in.
So let me ask you a question. How come there's not a recording of whatever was chasing it?
Look at him. He knew he was about to die. Maybe nothing was chasing him. Maybe there was an outbreak.
What is that based on, Ellie?
I've seen it before.
This isn't Africa, Ellie.
In outer space.
I saw his head explode a couple of hours ago.
Uh-huh.
I know infection when I see it, Charlie. You know that. There was something inside it, something on a cellular level, maybe even genetic.
Who cares, honey? It doesn't matter, okay? It's not why we came here, Ellie, and finding out what killed a bunch of goddamn aliens 2,000 years ago, it changes nothing.
What do you want to change?
You saw that face underneath that helmet, Ellie. They are not gods. We're just some experiment. And the Earth was a goddamn petri dish. That's it. But you're never gonna prove that with a bunch of 2,000-year-old mummies. Okay, fine. So why are you here, huh? What did you travel light years to get here to ask for, huh? What, for the meaning of life? What, for forgiveness for your sins? Or maybe to ask God why he traded you for your mom? Or maybe to ask him why he took your father?
Oh. No. Elizabeth, sorry. Stop it.
Not much has changed from Spates' script for this scene, other than my terrible voice acting. I do my best. As mentioned previously, we see elements of this scene in Noomi's shooting test, or screen test, whatever you want to call it. Sadly, I can't track down a sample of this scene for you to hear, but it is on the Blu-ray, but, you know, I have no way to convert it. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TraviaDesigns.com, TraviaN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.